All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're coming from. This is Ryan Owen Dimitri. You are listening to The Controversial Exchange. Welcome. We are hot off of our episode with Merrill Winston, where I'm pretty sure he tried to burn the fucking house down, right?
No, dude, it was awesome.
It was fantastic. If you haven't listened to it yet, please check it out. We decided to just hop on the mic and riff on this one, see where we'd go. Turns into a highlight reel of what's to come and where you can start to get a sample of or an idea of what's going to be coming on the show. If you want to have any input, please feel free to comment, share resources.
And primers.
Like that.
Put some primers out there so you guys can do some reading if you're interested in being a lot more informed so that the conversation's a little easier to flow.
Yeah, so this episode's just a highlight, I'd say, of the next what's to come over the next 5 to 6 episodes on this channel. With the disclaimer of we've got 2 already recorded in the bag, 1 on mental health and 1 with Carl Binder that'll be out as well. So yeah, soak it up, listen in, let us know what you think. And anything else to add, Dimitri?
No, man. I think you covered the whole thing. I'm really looking forward to it. This is a super fun one. I think people are going to enjoy it. Us just getting stream of consciousness, just talking and not thinking.
That's right. Let's just roll that intro then. We have a few different things going on. So everybody listening out there, if this is your first time, welcome. It is awesome to have you here. Why the hell have you not been listening soon?
I mean, like, right? Honestly... Yes, we are obviously the most superior situation on the internet, and not that that's not to diminish anyone else's capacity. That's just to emphasize the excellence of our own
pompous
situation.
Our pompous asshole.
There's nothing pompous about that. It's only pompous if it's not true.
Okay, so welcome. The goal is to have a fun, interactive, different type of podcast in this behavior analysis sphere. What we are coming up on next Wednesday, we talk with Matthew and Anita to talk about the current state of EAB, that is the experimental analysis behavior. And maybe this is something I can just riff on for
a second.
Dude, this is all anecdotal, but like Skinner talked about the flight from the lab and like farewell, my lovely, and how behavior analysis was kind of like losing its original vision of an experimental analysis behavior, whether that's his and the early founding fathers and foremothers, whatever. The fact is like, we know that the labs have consistently shut down for the last 50 years. The opportunity is to really work with an animal or anything that's not a human in an applied setting with autism or intellectual disabilities and such is like dwindling. There are some out there, props everybody, but like, I don't know. I see 2 things really consistently.
Okay.
It is either that those opportunities aren't there and they're extremely valuable, or that people just don't understand the importance of this experimental work and how it's translated into applied work. So I see this like neglect to respect the experimental analysis behavior and what foundations it's laid out. It's like, anytime you're working with a schedule of reinforcement, you have EAB to thank. You don't have the applied folks to thank for that. That research was done in a different domain. And I think that practice research gap is extremely important that we close that. And there are some very big issues there. But the thing is, you can't just like neglect an entire branch of our science as a result of like it not being immediately used.
Honestly, I think that you lose me, like not you, but that I get lost from that only because I just think out of the gate, it's a false dichotomy. I think the premise of the argument in and of itself is wrong. Like, I don't think that EAB is separate. I don't think there is a applied to practice or whatever, a lab to practice gap. Cause I don't think that, I don't think in terms of scientific inquiry, there should be a gap. I think both applied research informs first principles in a backward trend because sometimes you just make discovery. And I think that basic research or, you know, experimental research like you're talking about informs first principles because of its very strict adherence to very clear-cut experimental designs and basic experiments in general. So, I just think it's a false dichotomy. I think the biggest issue and the thing that I do agree with that you said is that the emphasis on autism and intellectual disabilities in terms of research has muddied the waters as far as like what the aim of behavior analytic research should be. And the aim of behavior analytic research should be to produce generalizable principles or first principles of behavior. And then there should be opportunities to try those or test them against a variety of different contexts and, you know, other types of independent and dependent variables. But instead, it's actually become an exercise in developing quote unquote evidence-based practice for autism treatment, where everyone's looking for a journal articles or experiments of tight, neat, clean treatment packages that they can just copy from a lit review that they would do and plug it into their practice. So for me, it's honestly just not teaching actually what the purpose of research and the purpose of the science of behavior analysis in terms of that side of what people do. So out of the gate, I don't disagree that it gets no respect. It gets no fucking respect. And it is dwindling dramatically. I just think the cause of that has to do more with people following that need for tight packages because they don't understand that first principles. I mean, that's what Merrill was talking about, how he was like, he makes up his own shit. He makes up his own shit because he goes back to first principles. Like, you know, he understands what a schedule reinforcement is, and then he starts playing with the idea of a schedule reinforcement in the context of whatever function he's identified, or, you know, whatever relationship he's identified, or whatever thing need that's been determined. And then he goes from there and builds a customized, individualized intervention for that person. And yes, is that intervention in and of itself going to be evidence-based? Some people are going to argue no, because no one actually tested that particular intervention in terms of an experimental context. But the reason they're fucking idiots if they say that is because the principles that it's based on are that way. You know, the argument that you need to have an experiment to test an exact intervention package that's based on first principles is absurd. That's like saying if you do an algebra problem, it's invalid because if you haven't necessarily tested a basic addition out of the gate before you get to that point, then it doesn't matter. You see what I mean? It's just stupid. Like, it's illogical.
I think where people are coming from there, though, is like, we don't have a defined way to teach people how to learn and operate with these basic principles of behavior, mainly because we can't even fucking agree what the basic principles of behavior are.
There's really only one.
No article, there's no resource out there that says, this is it, we're all in agreement. Nobody's done that.
Well, I mean,
they
have. B.F. Skinner did. It's called behavior is selected by consequences. How's that? Okay, yeah. There's one.
Okay, cool. Right?
I mean, like, what?
Like, we don't even have agreement.
So, what other principle do you really need? Then it's about manipulating the consequences, right? And that's where the philosophical, and that's where I get a boner about some of the stuff, because the philosophical issues come into play when I talk about my condemnation of PBIS, or I talk about my condemnation as antecedent manipulation as a formative intervention. It's because those things aren't fitting within the basic first principle of the science, and that's that behavior selected to consequences. So if you're manipulating antecedents, you're not manipulating consequences, and therefore you're not altering history, so you're not changing behavior. So what the fuck are you doing? Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So I mean, we could do a whole topic on that. Like, yeah. I think it's when the reliance on those strategies starts to go too far, which all of this is all relevant to, I think, what J.R. Cantor used to talk about. When a practice gets too far down the line and it turns into this cultural thing, that might be dogmatism, exactly, right? Or whatever. But it gets us too far removed from the natural events. And you can't blame anybody. Like, I guess this is, you had me thinking earlier, you can't blame any one person in our field for what they're doing, right? Like, if the consequences select their behavior and that's what's going on, then we have to look towards those sort of
things.
Yeah,
and that's where you lose me, man. Like, that's, go ahead.
Hold on.
My bad.
Hold on. Yeah, let me, yeah. So at what point, do we not start to blame our culture?
Okay,
like,
fair.
We need to have the right number of people coming together to guide this sort of thing. And this shit happens behind closed doors. So I was at a conference. I've been to a couple conferences this year. I'm going to use it, so I'm not like singling out one, but I've been to two conferences in 2019 where there are these subject matter expert groups. And they're labeled that because they don't look too controversial or anything like that. But at the end of the day, what's going on is you have a bunch of leaders in different respects in the field coming in together and planning out what they're going to do next. The thing is like, when's that going to be communicated? How much is that going on? How much has that formed our field? Like, at some point, is that why we started to have some of the problems that we have nowadays? Like, I'm pretty sure that's how the board formed, right? People got together. They said they need to do these sort of things. We did it. It is in the best interest of the field. However, like, at what point are you relying too much on certain people to guide that forward, right? And like, that's a lot of respect on your, on, or sorry, that's a lot of responsibility on somebody's shoulders to be doing those sort of things. But we, if it's going on, it's not, I mean, it's either not going on in our field right now in, with regard to like fixing this research practice gap and these sort of cultural problems, or they just really suck at doing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about EAB type scientific stuff?
Yeah.
Or I mean, because it's super hard, man. And the other thing too is that, like, again, like, there's only, I really, this is going to sound, someone's going to smack me in the face for saying this, but I'm going to be the guy who says it. Like, there's only so many things you can prove from a pigeon. There's only so many things you can prove from a rat in terms of basic operant conditioning principles, man. At some point in time, we have to look at multivariate experimentation so we can start getting true contextual first principles and like generalizable rules that we can operate under. So if,
for sure.
So I mean, like, I think maybe there should be some EAB with actual humans, and you're going to say, whoa, Dimitri, you're just like skimming eugenics there. You need to slow down. I hear you on that. And I'm not, you know, and I'm not saying let's start putting babies into operant chambers. But what I'm saying, though, is that there are ways, naturalistic ways to do that where it can be more of an exploratory scientific way to evaluate human behavior so we can start yielding more robust systems and designs like gold diamonds, more the constructivist contingency rather than the basic four-term or three-term contingency. You see what I'm saying? In which case, yeah, we would be deriving first-person principles like you want to from an experimental analysis of behavior, only we're doing it contextually as it relates to the complexities of the different variables that human beings encounter in the real motherfucking world. Like, that's, yeah, like, at some point in time we have to, like, and that's my thing with the lab issue. Okay, I understand that you can exert the most amount of prediction and control in the context of a lab. What I think is, and again, I'm going to say this and there's going to be somebody out there who can disprove it, and that's totally fine. I'm speaking in broad stroke generalizations. I would say with the exception of people doing very hyper specialized explicit specified work, we already have a good amount of information and a good amount of evidence-based knowledge that we need to now continue to grow and expand on and apply in different ways. Now, I don't want what I just said to be confused as me advocating for what I was criticizing earlier, which is that interventionist testing and experimentation thing of that like translational bullshit situation. But I'm talking about actually testing these things out on human beings in natural context to see how they actually hold up, you know, in the way that we do things. You know, one thing that I was reading from the Blue Books that was interesting, and it's not an analogy or anything that had brought to my attention before I'd ever really thought of, but the unfair comparison between hard sciences and social sciences, right? Because a lot of people say, well, like, you know, behavior is like astronomy. And I've even said something like that. But the thing is that the regularity of the planetary masses is the movement and gravity and the fixed nature of physics. Okay, makes it very much easier to mathematically engage in prediction and control. You actually don't even need to engage in control because you can't control planetary systems. You just need predictive models. Well, it's exactly the opposite with the human experience. The human experience is contacting complex variables all the time that are coming from all times of different unpredictable sides and angles and areas, which means that it's an irregular measure. Right. So irregular measures need more adaptive models to give you more robust interpretations of the natural world that you can actually apply to the various contexts and yield substantive answers when you have questions about why, what, and when someone's doing what the fuck they're doing. So
it sounds, I mean, two thoughts on all this, man. First of all, like, we need, so it sounds like the contextual behavioral science movement is just like the best home for you in the first place, right?
I mean, it's the most logical.
What they're focused on. I think it's the most logical. Not that it's like, I think, dude, if there could be a love child between Gold Diamond and the CBS movement, oh, would that,
yeah,
just,
I think,
like,
that would
be
like,
amazing,
that's what I was telling you before. Like, I think it's like proto-contextualism because it's almost like an EAB, it's an EAB framework. You know, it's an attempt to develop an EAB type framework that's first principle based, but in the context of, yeah, a natural world, which the lab cannot produce because of the sheer control that's exerted inside of it. Right. And also the subjects that, yeah, they can work within, which is rats, pigeons, and fruit flies. What and I know one guy is working with scorpions, so I don't know what the fuck. Like, again, scorpions are cool. Yeah. Like, that's pretty badass. Like, hey, what do you do for a living? Fucking work with scorpions. Like, that's sweet. You know, that's a pretty hardcore thing to say. But on the flip side, like, okay, man, you work with scorpions. Like, what the fuck can the scorpions do? They can jump through hoops? Like, what are we doing? Like, who gives a shit?
To kind of bring it back into what I was complaining about before and like how we have these people that seem to be organizing and influencing a certain way that the field's going. What I saw from the contextual behavioral science movement that's pretty cool, they talk about it as a reticulated model, and that is everything's kind of feeding off of each other, right? The applied, the experimental, the conceptual, philosophical, like all these areas are just kind of feeding off each other, poking holes and trying to like build itself up from all these different angles as it goes.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I didn't know that they referred to it that way. Dude, that's where I'm like, at then. That's the conclusion I've arrived to then also.
Okay. So that reticulated model is how Steve Hayes and others in that movement talk about and like describe like what the CBS movement's about. Now, when you talk to them even further, they're like, yeah, we have some huge gaps. Like in, for example, ACT to RFT and vice versa. Like there's some huge fucking gaps in the research there. Not that there isn't everywhere, but I don't know where that's happening in traditional behavior analytic like world. Like, I don't see
that's because the traditional ABI, behavior analytic like, world is doing BST every other fucking week, functional communication training the other weeks, and on the Sundays that they have free, they're focusing on other nonsensical things like reductionistic functional analyses that yield completely undifferentiated results. So,
or they're going to church.
So what the fuck ever on that?
So. Is this purely like the market driving this? Because that's where I start to fall. Like, we found an area where we could be effective and help people out. And it seems that all of our infrastructure started to be built that way simply because of that need. And it's not to blame anybody in that. But do you think this is purely market forces? Like, that's an interesting question. Like, I don't know. Like, I got into business because An undergraduate at the University of Nevada, Reno, I got into a business administration minor because I thought, this is safe. Like, there's always going to be business around me no matter what I'm doing. Like, having some knowledge of that would be useful. As I got further, like, into business and learning things, I realized that, like, the market can dictate so much, right? Like, I really, at this point in my career, in my life, believe that it's us as a community, largely, this is like leaving some room for there's some badasses out there that are good at this, but we don't understand how to work at the cultural level. We understand, if we're trained well, how to work at an individual level of analysis and help somebody out. When you're talking about how do we move forward as a culture, dude, I could look back at the OBM books and the different books on my shelf that are talking about this, and like, I've yet to find anything that I'm that works. Like, it's either not something that's practical or it's too conceptual.
I am not a believer
but like,
in OBM.
I haven't seen shit that moves forward.
I'm not a believer in OBM the way that other people are. I think that OBM in general is a really beautiful idea that in reality gets completely muddied and muddled because it cannot engage in the multivariate adaptive responsiveness that markets dictate and require. And really what I'm saying is the flexible ethics and the flexibility and practice that you have to operate under constraints of money. So like, that's cool. OBM is beautiful. And it's like, it is to me, OBM is the prime exemplar of lab to practice gap. Like, it's beautiful ivory tower people who have never actually run a business in their life telling people who run businesses how to run businesses based on behavioral principles. But then in reality, when you go to execute it in that fashion, it's either so fucking expensive that it'll bankrupt you if you do it, or it's so administratively intensive that it eats up so many resources, it becomes a fucking complete dredge on the system, and requires so much effort that eventually people just chuck it and go back to whatever the least effortful manner they did business beforehand.
Yeah.
So like, dude, if it doesn't work, it's useless. You know what I mean? And it doesn't. Most of those systems don't really work. I mean, small elements of them do, but they don't. And people would disagree with me, but they're wrong.
My couple thoughts on OBM is that it has been branded by some in the field to as clearly as a move forward to be able to kind of keep that certain brand going. So you can see that there's certain people that talk about it because it helps with their livelihood. And that's easy to understand why they do that. Not that I agree with it. The second thing is, I think under really isolated cultures, you can have phenomenal results, and that those things are very hard to replicate. So
a good example, that's a wonderful point.
Abernathy's Walden 4 book that he came out with, I believe it was published after he passed away. But it was in a seminar at the University of Nevada, Reno in a summer, and I was reading the draft copy, and he created this like perfect system where it was like this cultural level trying to recreate kind of like a Walden 2S sort of thing in this area, or in this company, and he did it successfully, but he never was able to replicate it. And the other area that I've seen this in is, and this is critiquing from the outside, but like I've seen some centers, like a good example is some precision teaching based centers where you have like the most passionate, just like go for it staff that are just like in line. Like I was talking to one yesterday where they haven't lost somebody from them being upset about their organization for like 9 years. Like they only lose people to graduate school and like moving across the country because like loved ones are dead. Like, they don't experience turnover, but I think those things are so rare, man. And then the last point is, I've yet to have a conversation with somebody like an Aubrey Daniels that has a lifetime of experience of implementing these things outside of our practice world of intellectual disabilities and autism. And that is the last thing that would really solidify, I think, some of my strong points on OBM. Because I've found, like, my OBM in a nutshell is, I've yet to find a model that has been extremely useful for me with any regards. I picked up little pieces and bits from all the stuff that I've read, but it's just fucking applying the same stuff in a human work setting. Like, there's nothing special. I don't need to talk about it in a different way. I don't need it for terms. I just need to alter who I'm providing this sort of stuff to. And I think someone like an Aubrey Daniels might sway me if I had an honest conversation with what was it like applying this in other domains and other industries, right? Because like I want to be really critical about it in the same ways that you were, and I agree with those now, but like that could sway me if someone like Aubrey was like, why that costs so
much. I mean, bro, I'm a scientist, so I mean, like, give me evidence and I will change my mind always. You know, and I'm just speaking from my own experience. I've done the FIT applied OBM thing. I've done gone through some the not completed the practitioner's portion of the six boxes thing, but I've been through the educational portion of it. So I mean, like, and I've been doing pretty high level organizational behavior management for quite a few years. So, I mean, I can talk about my own practical experience as well in that regard. So, I mean, like, I feel like I have at least a reasonable threshold or baseline from my own practice and experience to say these things.
You know what you just reminded me of? This summarizes my OBM experience in a nutshell. Graduated 2013 from Florida Institute of Technology in Orlando's brick and mortar campus. There was two people that were close to me in, they were in the Melbourne campus, and they had us kind of pitted against each other to kind of like try to outcompete each other. And at the end of graduation, the two folks that I was like best friends, like the not best friends with like best friend sense, but like knew the best over there, we were having a beer after graduation. And they're like, "Hey, do you know how to get a job in OBM?" And I was like, "You just spent $60,000 to get a master's degree and learn about OBM. And you don't have a job lead? Like, what the fuck did you just pay for?" Like I would be freaking out. And they were, rightfully so.
Yeah, it's the philosophy degree. It's the philosophy degree of behavioral sciences.
Dude, if you're interested in OBM and listening to this, get the practical hands-on experience however you can. Like, that is also what happens in the MBA world, dude. I didn't go for my MBA. I could have learned a shit ton from it. There's times where I'm like, yes, I should probably go back and learn some things like this. I had folks that were, so I took that business administration minor, and there was folks that came out of their MBA and were not finding themselves in the leadership and manager positions that they wanted to be in with their MBA. And it's because of practical experience.
Yeah, man.
Moving on that practical experience. Of course. And it's not the degree. That's like, if you're expecting the OBM degree to get you an OBM job, like, first of all, your first search is like, who knows about OBM? Like, Google that shit. Like, who's talking about OBM that's not in behavior analysis? That's like a good litmus test as to like, will people find this sort of thing of value? And it's not that it's not valuable. It's that you have to pair it with the experience to be able to get those sort of positions, man. Like,
I mean, that's to me, that's so self-explanatory. It's crazy. But I mean, like, I mean, that's just like, go do the work but I mean, that's like what you should teach, like, regular undergrads, freshmen, and students in general. Like, that was my complaint in undergrad. You know, I would go to all these seminars, like, people that major in philosophy average about 40 grand a year coming out of college. Well, I mean, they left out the fact that some of those people have parents that own businesses, or they go into construction and completely unrelated fields, you know, and are grinding themselves to the bone to make their livings, and or they're factoring in people across their entire lifespan. So after 40 years of grinding, now they make a reasonable wage, and that average is high up. You know what I mean? And they also they don't talk about the low ass entry level reality of it, and it's completely disingenuous and misleading. And I think that's just university culture in general, of like the sales side of like what colleges are like, and the failure of higher education to prepare students about reality. That's, you know, to the expectations game that you're talking about. But back to the OPM topic in general, again, do I think that there are some interesting things? Yes. Do I think that there are always going to be interesting things and that kind of thing? Yes. Do I think that you would get more, in my opinion, from just having good foundations and basic first principles of behavior analysis, and then exploring leadership literature, which is more like exploring how to cultivate yourself as someone who inspires people and people want to follow, and who understands the dynamics, the various social dynamics in the context of a workplace, so you can put together a foundational team that can operate together and to complete a task or to achieve success within the context of a cause. You know, I think you'd be better served
putting
organizational behavior management tools into practice.
I agree with you. If I play devil's advocate, like many people probably are.
Yeah, right, I hope they are.
It's like, how the fuck do I get that experience?
You do it, bro.
Like, you just described the best system ever, but where is
it? Yeah, and where it is real life, like everything else. I mean, no, for real. Like, substitute for experience, man. And, you know, it's interesting because I was having some conversations recently, which are hilarious. And, I mean, this is, if the person hears this, like, it's not personal, right? Nothing but love. But we were talking about, like, you know, we were having a conversation. I'm like, you know, don't take this the wrong way, but the difference between us is that you saw a war movie and think you understand war, and I'm someone who's been in the war. So, and you're trying to tell me what it's like. We can't. Those are two incompatible things. Like, you don't really understand. You have a conceptual understanding without a pragmatic, emotional, experiential understanding of it. They're different things. Apples, they're apples and basketballs. They're not even both fruit. You see what I'm, they're absurd. So it's a disingenuous comparison, and there's no substitute for real life. So what I would say to anybody looking to gain experience in anything is to, number one, write down the thing that you want to get experience in. And I mean, detail it. I want to learn how to manage people, or I want to learn how to be a leader in this X, Y, and Z to accomplish Y goal. Cool. Now you go and you're like, okay, what are the various opportunities out there that would lead to this? And what am I qualified to do? Well, I've never done this a day in my life, but I do have a master's degree in behavior analysis, and I got really lucky and I passed my test on the first try. Okay, cool, good story. You're a BCBA. So I'm going to go out there and it's like, okay, I could probably get a job managing a small team of people that do some form of intervention stuff, right? Okay, great. Now go do that. And then while you're actually doing that, rather than just going through the natural motions that you were taught in terms of, like, you know, BST, train, role play, model, rinse, wash, repeat, troubleshoot, okay, enrich yourself outside of the field and learn about leadership, learn about how to inspire people, learn about narrative, learn about how to frame things in understandable ways and how to break them down and play with it a little bit. And also learn how to conduct the functional analysis on a regular person without them even knowing that you're doing it. Because being able, the greatest tool in our tool chest as behavior analysts is being able to identify people's motivations, okay, and being able to identify the function of their behavior. If you can identify someone's why, you can get them to do backflips for you, because you can leverage their desires to optimize their performance. there's no difference between your clients or your staff as far as that goes. You just be able to identify their why and leverage it to maximize their performance. So that's what you that's the goal in my point of view. And you do that with one person, you do that with two people, you do it with three people, you do it with a team of people. And the next thing you know, you've been doing it in the context of like 5, 10, 15 people, and you have enough experience to substantively have an understanding and an experiential manner to articulate that. That practice that you've done, rather than some a conceptual intellectual exercise that you never actually felt or did in real life. That's a distinction that matters, and that's a distinction that you go tackle.
Yeah, and what you just described is like the core of OBM. It is the core of behavior analysis. It's the core of autism treatment. It's the core of acceptance and commitment therapy. It's understanding how to identify functions of behavior. And I don't know, man, like it's hard to put that lens on because of our histories. But dude, when you do that, like when you figure out how to start doing that quickly, you can move shit fast, right? Like you can move shit
absolutely
fast. It's so cool.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing too is you know, we've touched about this briefly in the past, in a couple past episodes, but, and I remember actually specifically, there was one episode where you asked me like, what do you think about this? And I'm like, there's a soft version and a hard version. But I mean, the reality is you have to actually do it. I think one hurdle in an administrative field like ours is that a lot of people, you know, or just the reality of it is that it's really easy to fall into, ruts. And not just ruts, but just general practices where you sit behind a desk all day and you don't actually do any of the stuff. You know, leaders lead. Leaders eat last. Leaders do. You shouldn't ask anyone to do anything you haven't done yourself. I've personally thrown up in the last 2 months, 3 times in front of my staff, because certain things really gross me out just by the presence of them. But you know what? If you should never ask someone to do something you wouldn't do yourself. And that's how you start setting the stage for establishing leadership. That's how you start setting the stage for going through your own experience. That's how you start building empathy with direct care people and lower level support staff. And that's how you maintain your connection to the masses and people when you start moving up into the ranks, you start making more broader organizational decisions and things. You know, staying grounded and not forgetting where you come from is pretty critical in this arena, especially in our kind of field where we're talking about massive burnout rates and turnover and mitigating all that stuff from an OBM context, right? Because the way that you build culture, like back to the thing you were talking about, how do you create a team of diehard people? Like you were talking about, the efficacy only exists in situations where you have this crack team that's all committed to the cause and blah, blah, blah. And that's all well and good, but yeah, that's like waiting for lightning to strike. If you really want to be efficient and good at something, you have to become the type of person who can create lightning. Well, how do you do that? You have to cultivate the skill set of generating those things. And you have to cultivate the skill set and cultivate the practice of bringing that out in others. And the way that you do that is practice and doing. Do, do, do.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like if there's a recipe of like how I went about this that I think isn't just my experience, but like useful for others to like implement, because I've seen others do it. And it seems like there's a few things. Like you need to have a strong mentorship component with the areas that you want to get into that you're not yet a master in. There is also this need for being able to search, first of all, and find like what to start consuming. And your mentors can help you with this, but it's the skill set of like knowing what terms to search for, right? Like what to actually try to find out there. After you have that and consumed it, then you have to know how to start applying those things. One of the best things that I ever got from one of my mentors was, he would say, when you read something, you should be basing whatever that new thing is that you've consumed, whether it's a podcast, whether it's a video, whether it's a book or whatever, how does that apply to what you've learned so far in your entirety of everything? Like if you switch that is now your only thing that you're going to be relying on, like you're in a bad spot. You should be taking that tool, that resource, this thing you just consumed, comparing it to your history of everything that you've learned so far, figuring out how to move forward with that thing as like a tool in your toolbox, not the only fucking tool that you're going to go out there and use. Has there been things that have been consistent for you? Like, I think the the thing that OBM helped me with the most, and I still just ended up using like a conceptual model of some sort and a fucking whiteboard and a group of people to solve this problem. But it was just understanding the systems and what influenced systems. So for me, it was like, here's our problem. We have this sort of problem going on in the organization, right? We just get a whiteboard conceptually and start figuring out what are all the different variables that are putting pressure on this system and like influencing it. And we map all of that.
Man.
Once we have that mapped out, it's just a matter of like, what strings can we pull legally, ethically, morally, right?
Like you start going through this practically. And that's, so again, not to backtrack and go back to previous episodes, like that will help me clarify a point. That's what I was saying when I was saying I don't think, like, I think that all these ridiculous distinctions we have amongst the different subsets are absurd. The reason I said I don't think there should be a thing like OBM in the past is because the process at which you'd go about solving an organizational problem should not be different than the process you go through for solving an other type of behavioral problem. Just because it's in the context of an organization doesn't mean that the same first principles don't apply. How do you solve behavior problems? Exactly the process you just said. Well, first and foremost, you need to actually define your problem. What the fuck are you trying to solve? You know what I mean? Like, what are you trying to actually solve here? Because a lot of the time, people get lost in the weeds and they start going down rabbit holes and they don't actually stay focused on the problem. So yes, first and foremost, identify the problem. Secondly, identify the influences or the variables, right? What are the factors? What are the environmental variables influencing the particular behavior in question or problem in question? Well, gosh golly, I wonder if that's how we do it with normal situations outside of organizational context. So far, it still sounds the same to me, right? And then you go down the list. Okay, what resources do we have to actually accommodate, you know, these different things that we want to do? Okay, do we have the people in place? Do we have the money? Do we have the resources? What are the regulatory restrictions? I feel like we're just checking the same boxes we would in any other context, right? It just so happens to apply in that setting. So again, that was like when I said before, like I don't think there should be those art distinctions, is because I don't think the troubleshooting process is different. I think it just so happens to apply to a different kind of problem and people are used to conceptualizing it. So it's difficult for them to generalize the skills in that way. But again, you only learn things through practice. Practice makes perfect, right? Repetitions. Get your trials in. Get the reps and you develop the skill. You'll start gaining fluency. That's how it works, right? You get more and more accurate and you get faster and faster and faster and now you're fluent at a thing. But you have to first and foremost actually go through the process and contact some consequences because that's how behavior is selected. There's a little full circle for you, bud.
So I'm pulling up something. I'm going to see if it works. So I think...
I'm not going to lie. That's so good.
I think where some OBMers might argue here is that like their systematized approach to solving whatever problem...
Okay, so time out. Systematized approach, like, different than what? Other behavior analytics systematized approaches? So like...
No, like I'm just saying like the fact that they have a fucking checklist and a process to go through limits the errors.
Right, yeah. An idiosyncratic copyrighted thing that they did that they can sell you is more special than a general first principle evaluation.
No, and like, that's my problem. But the thing is like when you put it into... When you put it into a system to where people can now follow, like that's what
right.
People
it dummy
like.
Proofs it. About this. You're talking about dummy proofing stuff. That's my point. Like, it's the desire to reach out and grab that prepackaged, pre-selected intervention rather than taking the time to actually engage in analysis. Like,
yeah.
Okay, it's dummy proofing it. You know, and I get it. We don't have time. We're restricted by time and resources and effort and fucking feelings and stress and life and kids and spouses and, you know, whatever, gravitational pull and climate change and politics and the news and our Facebook feeds and shit. I get that life's complicated. I'm not saying it's not. And sometimes it's just really easy to pay the $3,000 and have something you can plug and play and not worry about. I'm not judging people for that. But but that doing it and being honest about those motivations and that process over having a serious conversation about how different it is than actual just general behavior analytic processes is preposterous. You see what I mean?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's a fucking bullshit proposition. It's nonsense to me.
I mean, I guess you might have some like, it's easier on the administrator side if I was teaching these sort of things to like, put people on a track and like help them get their practicum and such, right? Like, I guess it, if anything, it makes it easier for people to teach this line of thought. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's like if you create a standard, right, you start yielding more consistent results. So you're talking about like how it helps set a standard. And by doing that, you get less variability in your results. And that's a valid thing too. I'm not saying that's not the case. Okay. But I don't see how you couldn't just create your own standard thing. Like, why do you need the prepackaged thing?
I mean, because it sells.
Exactly. So, I'm just to be clear, I'm a capitalist, man. So like, if you're out there making money doing that, and you're listening to this, and you're like, these guys are totally taking a shit on my business. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to do that. You know, God bless you. Go out there, free market reign. You know, that's what made America beautiful. Okay, I'm with you. All right. But on the flip side, like, that's my responsibility, is to speak the truth, or at least that's been my commitment. And to me, that's the raw reality of it, whether or not it negatively impacts your business or not.
So I'm trying to like provide, I feel like we've gone over the place here, which is good. Like, we're diving into all these different things. I wanted to give an example of the, so we struggled with this as practitioners, myself and a colleague of mine, Tom, a few years ago. And we were trying to figure out, what are the contingencies that lead people to alternative routes other than behavior analysis? Or like that, I mean, you can see that it also applies to like what leads you to looking into behavior analysis.
So this is kind of spinning off of the idea of like the prepackaged stuff, and like, why would you go for prepackaged stuff rather than just doing the,
but like prepackaged stuff could also,
I'm just trying to follow the line of thought.
You could be looking at like, why do people head into cognitive psychology, social psychology, other areas of psychology rather than behavior analysis too? Like, this all applies, and we're trying to figure out like what's going on there. So for us, there was a bunch of things. You have the rules, the laws of verbal behavior. Like, there's a lot of things that kind of come down to this all. And so we started with these domains. You have the practitioner, the potential future practitioners, those people that are like, I think that this field might be interesting, I'm considering it. You have the instructors, the general public, the consumers of your services, the employers, the policymakers, and the observer themselves, which is the person that's experiencing this themselves. Like, that's the level of the scientist, like navigating the system, right? And for all of those, you have all these issues. You have legal issues, educational issues. You have public interest issues, exposure issues, and competition issues. So like, all of a sudden now, when you're trying to figure out like, why doesn't behavior analysis get more limelight, you now have to think about those five issues I described in the context of all of those all those different levels, right? The observer, the policymakers, the consumers, the employers, the general public, the instructors, the potential future practitioners, and the current practitioners. And then you have to multiply all of those, right? Because all those are interacting with each other. So now all of a sudden your systems analysis just turned into a clusterfuck of, I have like 180 million different ways in which these things can interact and influence each other. And like that, I guess that was the most useful thing out of all of organizational behavior management that came from me, is like, how do you start to think about all the variables that are impacting a system?
Dude,
to figure out which ones you can start to work with.
All,
you
know, behavior is multiply controlled.
But yeah, and that way you just added a level of complexity. Like, if I'm looking at something like how to...
All behavior, like, is multiply controlled, because like, I dare you to find an organization or a human being that exists in a vacuum and is contacting a singular consequence. They don't exist, so that's not real.
Have you seen it's theoretical. Have you seen
how
Florida's Medicaid's like imploding?
We talked about that.
They just came in with a like half rate cut on the RBT position, I think, this Monday. Super rough. But like, dude, I'm not in Florida, I'm not providing service in Florida. I used to provide service in Florida. I provided services at an organization in Nevada that had shitty rates. We used to provide, it still is the rate in Nevada, $40 a day for an 8-to-1 ratio.
That's adult service shit, man. That sucks.
And you get $40 for that person.
God. And then they wonder why people's lives at that, people, adults with disabilities' lives are so abysmal outcomes, because funding is so terrible, dude.
I would go on record of like, this is a horrible system to be providing services in. It is not financially the most smart thing to do. It is not the best thing for outcomes.
It's so sad, man.
Dignity, respect, ethics. It's all fucked up. It's wrong. The first step to solving these sort of issues, though, is realizing that there's all these different factors that are impacting things. And I feel like most behavior analysts want to do the right thing when it comes to these things, like what's going on in Florida with Medicaid issues right now. But they they don't stop to look at like, what are all the variables and what is the best way to target this? Like,
yeah,
you'll just get keyboard warriors or people raising their hands, right? Oh, like you man. Get people as they, like, I'm not blaming them as a human. Like you should get pissed off. And like,
oh man, do you think that someone would be listening to this though and tag us with that? Like these motherfuckers, like these guys are just on their microphones talking shit. Like, and they're not doing shit. Like, are we hypocrites?
I see. Like, I don't feel like I am in this situation. I've got mixed feelings. People may tact it as that in the first place. The thing is I've worked in really shitty rates and I've had to work on similar issues in Nevada. And what I learned from that was that you cannot do anything by yourself. You need to have the most coordinated attack possible to be able to work on these sort of things if you're under the gun like they are now. Like you have somebody else that has the leverage in this situation in Florida, which is the people with the money, and they have the leverage. You have to have the most coordinated possible move to be able to move that sort of conversation forward as possible. The other side of that, dude, which I think I'm trying to figure out, I don't know the solution now, but I think that people, I hope to solve this problem. I hope in later years that those folks that might critique me now would like re-listen to me again, is this is a defense game of what's going on. When someone says like, we're cutting rates in half, you're now on the defense side. You don't have leverage. You have to figure out how do we try to bring as many people together as possible to try to reconcile and like alleviate some of this damage. The thing is if we were really strong on the offense side, dude, for the last like 40 years, we would have figured out all the gaps in our research, right? We would have like had this reticulated model. And we would have been like really, really clear. Like,
woulda, coulda, shoulda, didn't. So,
dude, and that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's a fucking systems problem, dude. Yeah. Like, this, woulda, this field, coulda,
shoulda, didn't.
This field is a systems problem of like proportionate and fucking amazing and ironic scale. Like, we created this problem when we knew how to not create this problem in the first place. Right.
Yeah, I think that's why. Like, that's why, sorry, personally, I view it as an individual sport.
Hold on, I'm saying not that Florida one. That's not what I was referencing there. But systems problems in our field, are like our own grand making. Like we understand this and why this happens. It's just like we aren't coordinating our efforts enough to make it happen. And you got to do that on the offense side, which I mean is.
I know my point is I don't think that's possible.
I don't know, dude.
I don't think it's possible. I don't think.
So are you saying like it's not
I'm possible saying that if that were possible, communism would work. Like it's not possible.
See, this is where I think this is why certain, you can look to other places, man. Pick a business, dude. Pick Gary Vaynerchuk's like media empire that he's creating. It's small in some regards, it's huge in others. And like, I think that's what you're getting at when you're talking about somebody that has, like, he plays a game, like he plays the individual game. It's like, how can he move forward? Yeah, it's not perfect, but dude, like we suck on so many levels, many of us, like working together or working to move things forward. Like the best thing we could do is come together, drop our egos and say, how could we do this better as a community? Right. This is a good transition into other things that we're going to have on this show soon. So ABI 2019 Chicago, they invited myself, Matt Sequoia with the Behavioral Observations Podcast, and
I have a symposium on functional analysis also. I will.
Jonathan Pinkston, I believe is his name. I've yet to meet him in person, but Derek Reed helped organize and make this thing happen. And the idea is science communication, missed opportunities. Like, what are we missing here? And the idea and the context there is like, I think so far, this is from my perspective, that we communicate a lot in our public journals and in different ways at our conferences, but are we missing opportunities by communicating in video or audio formats, right? So that's why Matt and I are on this sort of thing. And yes, it's an extremely fucking white panel. We will be taking input and listening to others. But what we wanted to get at is, I know someone's going to bitch about that at some point. The people search and find that shit fucking immediately. Anyhow, the point is like we aren't coordinating ourselves. Like, what are we missing by not coordinating ourselves? That's kind of like what we're asking at this panel. Like, how much is our field really missing out on because we don't fucking pull ourselves together enough? Does that make sense?
Man, I mean, I hear you. I just don't I don't think that that's a reasonable expectation, man.
Yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Dude, like, well,
you can't,
I mean,
you can't, there's 300 million adults in this country and they can't get more than half of them just to go and push a button once every 4 years, man.
Yeah.
You think you're going to coordinate a field of 37,000 egomaniacal maniacs who have been told how fucking genius they are at everything to do anything together? That's crazy.
I feel you, but that's what people do. They look up to these entities to be able to do those sort of things. And the reality is, I don't know how much they're doing it. Like, I don't know, dude. I'm getting burnt on the fact that I got into and I sold that there's a field that understands behavior and could save the world when we can't even get the right fucking people together to organize ourselves to move shit forward.
Yeah, I think that's faulty reasoning, man. I don't think that why does the effort have to be communal? Like, why can't it be that you learn this scientific practice and you learn these first principles of what govern human behavior and you go out there and you do it? Like, great invention is an individualized sport. Okay. Like, it just is. Tesla didn't have, I mean, like, it's just how it is, man. Yeah. I almost said Edison. People are gonna be like, Edison stole everybody's ideas. Okay. Whatever. Okay. But Einstein sat by himself with the pen and paper and came up with relativity. So, I mean, like, I just don't agree with the idea. I don't agree with the premise out of the gate that that should be an expectation and the reality of it. It's not a group sport. It's not a team sport. Life is an individual sport.
We're taught like that, and that's how it's supposed to be, right?
Oh, I mean, man. And if hopes and dreams and puppy dogs and unicorns were real, we'd live in a fucking beautiful place and everything would be wonderful and there wouldn't be starving children. But I mean, we don't. So, I mean, that's all good and gravy, but we can talk in terms of blind optimism and blind idealism, and we can have a realistic talk about where things are, and also we can talk about what can actually get accomplished. Like, to me, it would be counterproductive to go things that way. I think you're going to get a lot more interesting outcomes if you have 37,000 people substantially pursuing their interests to the nth degree and seeing what they derives from it, rather than 37,000 people trying to support, you know, a small group of the, you know, of the upper echelon of them guiding them, right? I think, you know, that's funny because this leads into kind of like an offshoot. I read an interesting article today about China's social rating system.
Dude,
have you heard of this?
Gnarly, right?
Gnarly. It's fucking terrifying.
Dude,
it's literally an episode of the Black Mirror, man.
And it's real life. It's
science fiction become reality, dude.
It's rolling out, dude. Like, it's real.
Yeah, and it's twisted behavioral dark side shit, bro. It's all the things people are afraid of when you talked about, like, what Walden 2 would look like in real life. I think we're finding out, and it's pretty fucking scary. Okay? Like, not cool, dude. Literally, like, whether or not you get access to high-speed internet, depending on how someone graded your interaction with them, you know what? You get a 4-star Uber review, so you're going to get fucking dial-up for the next 3 weeks, asshole. Like, that's horrible, man. That's garbage. That's a totalitarian fascism fucking to the extreme. Like, that's so fucking scary. So, again, like, is that what would happen if you organized 37,000 behavior analysts? No, of course not. But the point I'm trying to make is the same. Is that, like, whenever you look to do some type of shared output that does not necessarily match people's motivations, you get a very twisted, programmatic, controlled system that eliminates choice. And I don't know about you, but to me, choice is what separates, it's our ability to make abstract decisions and choices is what separates us from every other animal in the animal kingdom, you know? So I don't think that we should divorce ourselves from the uniquely human thing that we have, and we should always maximize our ability to make choices. So that's where I'm at on that. I just disagree with the fundamental premise of it.
Did you ever see Israel Goldiamon's degrees of freedom?
No, but that, I think that's actually in the next section, because I just got done reading some of the prediction and control stuff, and I'm pretty sure that's the next section.
Yeah, so real simply for listeners, he says, like, if you had 10 choices, it's the white space between those, right? The nine little white spaces would be, you have 9 degrees of freedom when you have those 10 choices, those 10 options in front of you. And so you're talking about, like, that's what separates us. I don't know if it does separate us. Like, it seems like we have a skill set allows us to maybe work on creating more opportunities for us than others.
I mean, listen, we can go down the rabbit hole, free will being an illusion, and I'm not going to debate that. Okay.
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, isn't it all just degrees of freedom? Like, how many degrees of freedom do you have under this opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, cool. All day. Yeah, for sure. I'm with that on that.
That's one thing that, I guess that was a really useful tool for me, man, the degrees of freedom, because it was an easy tool to advocate too. Like, we could eat, dude, it was so simple. We could give it to parents and be like, hey, if these changes happen, so like when Nevada's rate changes were happening and things like that were going on, we'd say, hey, when these things happen, this is what happens. You went from 9 choices and 8 degrees of freedom to now 6 choices and 5 degrees of freedom. They are literally restricting your degrees of freedom. Is this worth whatever outcomes are being promised, right? Because I don't know, and like, just because you have less choices doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't like going to lead to a better quality of life per se. But I mean, it depends on the situation, I guess. But it's one of those things where it's like an easy tool for you to start to think about, how do you communicate the value of these choices that you have offered to you at the moment?
Yeah, I love that. I'm with you. I'm with you, man. I love that analogy, that notion that freedom's in the space, in the white spaces. Whoa, that's pretty heavy shit. That's pretty heavy.
This is okay. So we've hit two of the recording things that we're going to come up on. The next one that we have. So the one that I mentioned about the ABI recording, that's not until May. We're going to have that out, and there's going to be some options for input. If you have any ideas on what we just rambled on, let us know. The other one that'll be fun is something the effect of like the behavior analyst's guide to junk science or bunk science with
Matt, I'm looking forward to that one.
With Matt Norman and Hank Schlinger. So I don't know, dude. Like, yeah, it's gonna be a blast. So
talking shit about pseudoscience is one of my favorite sports. It's just an opportunity for me to take a shit on OTs for 45 minutes to an hour. I love it. Is your girlfriend listening to this? I hope not.
Yeah, right.
Just kidding.
She's very pragmatic. You could use that as an example. Like, she's someone as an OT that struggles because she's like, I was taught shit that I now have to go back and rethink, and because it's not working in practice, and like I have to rethink shit. So like, I think all helping professions run into this to some degree. The question would be how much. But dude, like, we're taught to believe shit, and we need to be taught to believe shit and also match it up to whether or not it's working in real life, whether or not those contingencies are actually playing out, right? And like, is it leading to the outcomes that we're trying to reach here?
Well, if anybody wants to do a pre-reading or like just like a primer reading for that episode, I would suggest downloading, and it's that chapter is actually free on the internet, Carl Sagan's Baloney Detection Kit.
Yes.
It's a great it's a great chapter actually from a book called Science, A Candle in the Dark. But I really highly suggest that excerpt. It's available free if you just Google it, Carl Sagan's Baloney Detection Kit. That would be an excellent primer for some of like how that kind of conversation will probably be rooted. And then if you want more as far as like pseudoscientific stuff, we've talked about that previously on the podcast. But I would suggest looking at Richard Fox and James Mulick's book on Controversial Therapies and Autism Developmental Disabilities.
Which, this is a plug to Why We Do What We Do, the podcast I was a part of starting up. The 100th episode, which should be out already, is on that very topic. So go check that out if you want to have like an in-depth deep dive. It's really cool, man. We're bringing together ABA Inside Track and Matt with Behavioral Observations, kind of this big, big hodgepodge of behavioral podcasters. So the last topic I have is something on self-management. And this, man, I told you some, but essentially I was at the ACT bootcamp and there's this guy that was just like, you know what, man? This seems like it's cool. It's there's some useful stuff here, but he's like, I don't know. Like, I could easily be attending some sort of cult workshop. Like, I don't.
Dude, that's pretty fair though.
Yeah, dude.
That's not totally unfair.
Yeah. And I'm not, I don't know. Like, I think those things to a degree are okay and useful in our field, to be honest with you.
Okay. You mean the cult or do you mean the criticism?
Both.
Or do you just mean, oh, okay.
Both. Just don't get too culty. Like, you're starting to get back into that thing that's too much cultural. There's too much cultural influence of what's going on in the moment rather than keeping it with the natural events that you're there to talk about in the first place.
Gotcha.
So cool. It's this continuum that you're constantly trying to battle and like get close up on and make sure that you're as close to the natural events as you possibly can be while having conversation to move yourself forward. But dude, we were talking about self-management routines. I don't know how it came up. It was just dinner conversation about like, if you want to be good at something, if you want to figure this sort of stuff out, and if you really want to help somebody else out, should you not have the responsibility to also demonstrate that you can do it with yourself, that you can understand your own behavior and like influence yourself?
We were talking about that in the context of OBM. That's exactly what I believe. If for anything, man,
yeah, anything. Dude. Could you imagine if the part of your board's exam was also demonstrating that you can control your own behavior and influence it? You know how pissed Americans would be?
Look like? Would that be like you refrain from answering like, I don't know, odd numbered questions? Like what would that? Dude, how would they test that? Dude, that would be a weird thing.
Dude, imagine like a component of the bar exam. My understanding of some, I don't know. I'm not going to plan to understand all the legal world, but part of the bar exam I've been told is having to like in a peer-reviewed format like demonstrate some sort of argument about a case, right? Like you have to show that you can do these sort of things.
That's all
now imagine if it was like this peer-reviewed self-management, like I can manipulate these sort of things. Dude, would that not increase the quality potentially of our service, but also just totally just like disrupt and destroy how many people they could end up certifying at the end of the day?
I gotta be honest, I can't really wrap my brain around that, so I'm not sure if I understand how it would look. Like I'm trying to visualize or conceptualize what something that like that would even look like, and I can't get there.
Imagine, dude, I can imagine shit all day. I don't know if this is what
give me some examples here. Give me some analogies that I can place in my brain, because I'm trying to think of like what does a test of self-management look like. Because I mean, really what I'm thinking of, like, okay, a test of that would be, I don't know, the actual results that come from engaging in a self-management practice, but that requires an extensive period of time because, you know, you have to have consistent contact with the consequence to get the results. So
imagine that you're
how would you do that in a brief 4-hour period? You know,
what do they call those things that are your capstone. Imagine your capstone project was you for 6 or 12 months demonstrating some sort of set of self-improvement projects, right?
I'm actually doing that right now.
But, dude, this is
in
where,
school.
Like, you would need a couple things. You would need to be able to have a peer review on there. I think that would be critical. You'd have to have peer review. I don't think that you need to demonstrate necessarily certain knowledge, but certain skill sets of, like, how to do a reversal, right? Like things like that. Like how do you do these procedures would be the critical thing.
So what I'm doing right now, I'll just give you an example, is I'm taking a mindfulness and ABA class. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's learning about mindfulness and ACT and I don't know, it's meditation really is the big focus. And 99% of the class is developing a meditation practice. And a lot of it has to do with the research where if you consistently engage in meditation for 20 minutes a day for 8 consecutive weeks, you actually change your neurology, like your brain wiring actually shifts.
This is like what they tell you will happen, or this is demonstrated. This is demonstrated in research, or this is what.
They've done it through, like, they can demonstrate the shifts in EEGs. Like they have the research. You can look it up in the book Behave by Robert Sapolsky. You can look it up in the book The Buddha Brain by Richard Hansen and Richard Mendes.
You're telling me that if we alter our behavior, there's changes in our neurology.
Neurological makeup, yeah, in our brains.
Sorry, supposedly. I was just being a little facetious there.
I guess what I'm saying is that, like,
hold on, it's all connected. What?
Yeah, I know. But I guess I'm going to totally take a shit on this right now. So I'm going to take a turn here for the worst. So I'm week 5 of that.
Yeah.
And I absolutely fucking hate meditation. Like, I don't like it at all. But I'm engaging in the discipline of taking 20 minutes every day and still doing my guided meditations with this fucking app where I got some guy whispering in my ear to listen to the thoughts pass through me and take my deep breaths and stop. And just like doing the shit that like I find it so comical that it's hard for me to stay in the moment, you know, like, or like because it's so stupid.
We talked about this on the phone real quick the other day when I was on a layover. I've thought about it more since you brought it up. I think my issue is that it's assumed that it has to be a certain topography, a certain form of how to do it. Like, why can't I go into the gym like Arnold Schwarzenegger and just fucking pump irons like a goddamn ape? And like, why can't that be what I do for my mind?
Dude,
like,
I agree with you.
I honestly feel like what people talk about when they get into the Zen mode and this like mindfulness, like just that fucking flow state, right? Like, I don't get that under those circumstances like you, but dude, there's times when I could be on like the shittiest trail run of my life or like repping things out in the gym. And I feel it, dude. Like my thoughts are there where I want them to be or where I don't want them to be. Like I can turn those things on and off. If that makes sense. I could like,
oh dude, it makes sense. Like I'm the same boat, man. I'm a physical person. So it's not that I can't handle the stillness. It's that I have too much negativity in my mind and too much obsession and just too much noise to not be pushing myself physically in order to offset that energy. And I just use the word energy and people are like, oh my God, what the hell just happened to me? Totally the script on us there. But yeah, that's, I really do mean that. Like it's like when I'm sitting here and I'm lifting weights, okay. And I'm starting to feel the pain on the 15th rep. Right. Or like I've done my 60th squat on my third set and my legs feel like they're going to explode. Or like I'm doing, I don't know, corkscrew, whatever, bicep curls, and like my forearms are feeling like they're gonna explode out of my fucking arms. Like that's that to me, like having that like discomfort helps distract me from the negative thoughts, which actually is more effective for me personally than it is listening to some guy whisper into my brain. Like it sucks. And the other thing about that too is that, you know, I think that we underestimate the power of negative emotions too. Sometimes like I use hate as a motivator, man. Like I mean, some people think that's kind of sick or twisted or whatever, or they might think that's unhealthy and that's their prerogative. And yeah, I do have high blood pressure, but whatever, fuck it. And like, but I mean, like I like if I carry the amount of frustration that I carry and the amount of like anger and rage that I carry all the time, it helps me to fixate those things on a physical output and release them and use them as fuel and energy to maintain a higher level of productivity than I do when I'm in a totally calm Zen mode. Because one of the things that I'm finding, and this is actually also listed in a couple of different articles that they've shown that meditation can have this effect, is that when I do my meditative practice and I haven't completed whatever tasks I have for the day, I am so fucking unmotivated to do anything that it's seriously like I just smoked 800 pounds of dope or something. And I'm just like, what? I just like the amount of effort it takes for me to get off my ass and move is 7,000 times more than it was before. And it seems counterproductive. Like it's not a good experience for me. So I don't know. And they do say that some people don't benefit from it, whatever. And depending if you've had issues with depression and that kind of thing, or other mental health disorders. And so, I mean, that's also could be a factor, but I'm just like, oh man, it's weird. It's like I came into this idea and this opportunity with like a totally open mind and thinking this was going to change the way I view things. And I totally believed it was a thing. And then like the more I read and the more I practice it, the less convinced I am of its efficacy and the less I want to do and the less good I think it is.
Yeah, I'm
going to
do it.
Just the opposite result of what I was expecting.
So I've got someone in mind for this, but if anybody knows someone that's gone to like one of those like fucking 30-day retreats and just like gotten into this full force, we're looking for someone like that to talk about this on the podcast with. I feel like someone with that experience,
I would love crucial. To talk to an someone who's a real expert on this and not a complete nutter like troglodyte like I am, because I have questions.
Yeah,
I have a lot of questions. So if you could disambiguate them for me, I would really appreciate it. I think there's a lot of people out there that would benefit from it and would like to hear it. Mostly because it's also become a huge buzz thing in the field. Like so people much, are talking right? about mindfulness like crazy, but and like meditation like crazy. But I mean, when the rubber hits the road, like it just is not. There's something I don't understand about it personally, or like there's something that I'm missing. Cause I'm also having trouble really framing it in a behavior analytic fashion. Like it feels mega frou-frou mentalistic, man. like soup, and there's like a lot of religious undertones with the Buddhist stuff, and like, and I know there's a quite a few articles out there that that relate Buddhism to radical behaviorism, and I do see the correlates, but that doesn't take away from the heavy spirituality influences that are there, and it's you just I personally can't see past them for me to really be able to engage it.
I agree with you. I want to, it's kind of like when I was talking about with Aubrey Daniels earlier, like I want to have somebody in that conversation because I think it like would like help me at the end of the day, like reconcile some of the shit I've been thinking about. Dude, have you read the article by Steve Hayes and Barlow, Hayes and Barlow? I can't remember. It's on making sense of spirituality.
No, I can't say that I have. Let me see if I can.
An amazing piece.
Okay. So I'll look it up.
They're talking about perspective taking in there. Oh my God, dude. So like,
what's it called again? It's just perspectives and spirituality. Just Hayes and Hayes.
Making sense of spirituality. And I believe it's Hayes and it's not Hayes and Barlow because Hayes and Barlow is on mentalism and behavior relations, but it's,
I'll just look. I'm sure I'll find that on EBSCO or whatever, man. I'll find it.
So yeah, dude, it's dope. I think that with those other folks would be a sweet conversation to have. It's driving me nuts. Dude, I saw in one of the forums the other day, someone was, yeah, it's just Steve, 1984. Dude, check it out. Let's have a conversation on that sometime. His whole thing is like, can we make sense of spirituality? If so, then we should be able to make sense of anything else from a behavioral perspective. And of course, he brings in some of the CBS, like early RFT stuff to do that. It's where he, I think it's where he first talks about dialectic frames, which is the perspective taking.
Dude, and to be clear, ACT is the only thing that feels real to me.
Yeah.
Of all the stuff that I'm reading right now, like all the mindfulness research, all the stuff, like there's Dr. Nirbhay Singh. His research is legit. Single subjects, really nice control, cool. Legit to me. And all the ACT Hayes stuff. Everything else is total shit. Like everything else is total shit. Like I haven't, like, it's bullshit. Like, and again, that's my opinion. So disclaimer there, IMHO, but I mean like for real, I'm completely unimpressed.
I'm going to send this article off to the two people that I think would be rad to have that conversation with, and we'll see where
it goes. Oh yeah, let's do it, bro.
Okay. So the last thing we should probably talk about is the thing you're talking about at ABI.
What thing?
You're talking about FA stuff, yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we're having a little symposium. We're having a symposium.
But we're on also planning on making this a podcast episode at some point, too.
So I hope so. Yeah, we're doing we're doing a symposium on practical functional analysis. So it's basically going to be ISCA used in various formats and synthesized contingencies and then talking about that. So it's pretty cool. We're going to have Jessica Slayton as a discussant. Jessica's an amazing practitioner. I haven't met her in person yet. I've only exchanged emails with her, but she published a paper in 2017 that did a comparative analysis between ISCA and standard FA. And demonstrated how ISCA, or practical functional analysis, produces a 100% differentiation across all participants, where you get a 4 out of 9 running a standard FA, and then you only really get a 6 out of 9 if you do modifications to the standard FA. So even when you cheat, you only get 6 out of 9. So it's a really great article that really helps illuminate, in my opinion, why if you're a practitioner, you want to look at synthesized contingencies and why those matter and why reductionistic functional analysis is fucking shit. But, you know, if you're interested in that discussion, we're going to be having a symposium about that at ABAI on the Monday. So stop by and check us out and say hello. But yeah, so that's it. I really hope to have a podcast episode about it, because I have to say that like ISCA and functional analysis in general is like it's been the crux of my work, because I work in severe intensive problem behavior. So being able to identify functional relations is pretty critical to being effective, and also being able to keep people safe and being able to optimize human beings' outcomes. So, you know, discovering a tool that permitted and created the conditions to have a quick, easy, simple, effective, minimal extinction burst outcomes has been an absolute game changer in my personal practice. And I really look forward to seeing that discussion. And also, so another fun primer, if anyone's interested to know why this is such a heated debate, there's two YouTube videos I would direct you to. The first one is a debate between Wayne Fisher and Greg Hanley. which is pretty funny if you've done some lit review on the stuff. And then there's one, Brian Iwata's final interview or speech. The audio is not great, so you'll really have to dig through it a little bit and like play it with a higher volume, but it's on YouTube, where he basically very backhandedly talks epic amounts of shit. And that's cool, and that's all gravy, and you know, I guess even the dinosaurs screamed out before the meteor hit, so it's all gravy.
So for those listening, where Dimitri and I go back and forth on like, should we talk about this topic or should we just try to get some other people involved on these? And long story short, it's hard to get some people to sign up for podcasts. It's I think an issue of people not wanting to push a dichotomy further apart, or it's just not worth their time, or they don't see the value of these sort of mediums. So we're doing our best to get these folks involved.
I think it's also just like a fear of controversy, man. Like fear of like stirring the pot for no reason.
Yeah.
And like creating enemies and intellectual enemies for no reason.
And I think the biggest reason we're going to push forward on these sort of things, at least from my perspective, is that people deserve to have both sides of the argument. And there was so many times, dude, that I was like 5, 6, 8, 9 years into my career where it was like, oh, this is the reality of our field. And it's like, just fucking give it to the people early. Give it to them early so that they can start to sort through this shit early. We don't need to be like I've never agreed with this, like, oh, we have to give the ABC model to people before we give them the SDMO. Like, that's stupid. You're just teaching people to fucking think different and different and different. Like, they have to rethink shit. Just give them the model and give them the discussion or whatever that is beforehand so they can solve it. So,
yeah, and information, dude. Let people choose for themselves. Like, for me, it's more like getting, like, that's why the restriction of information in any capacity is ridiculous, you know, especially when it comes to scientific inquiry and a scientific discourse. Like, if we're going to have an intelligible conversation about something, all the different information and data points and data sets need to be presented equitably in such a way where people can see them. I think it's pretty disingenuous when I see how certain people use their status and stature to push their own research lines and hold the field back, in my opinion, again, because they have, you know, 5 or 6 articles in peer review that have been hanging out there for a couple of years. And if their fucking research lines get shit on, those articles get shit on, so they lose those publications. Well, and again, I'm not necessarily criticizing anyone specific who happens to have their number of publications in their license plate. But what I am saying is that is a pretty poor way to go about actually engaging in open, honest inquiry and pushing forward thought. You know, because being a scientist is about being a free thinker, and it's about exploration, and it's about going to those places that are uncomfortable and unknown so that you can discover new heights and new horizons. And you cannot do that if discourse is controlled by the few. It needs to be in the hands of the many. So I really, really, really feel like this is one of those things that the journals have been kind of open to, but not really. I think it's one of those things that a lot of bigger people have been very, very skeptical over. And again, philosophic doubt is important and conversations are important, but I think also it's one of those things where they shouldn't be able to control the conversation just because of who they are. Because the way I see it as a pragmatist is, what the fuck have you done for me lately? Number one. And number two is, what the fuck do you actually do? You know, because if all you do is do controlled experiments in a laboratory setting and publish papers, you don't actually serve the world. And I don't really give a shit about your opinion. Like, that's really how I feel about it. So I want to have those substantive discussions and I want to see where it goes. And I feel like people deserve this information because, again, as someone who works in the most extreme end of the spectrum of behavioral disorders, I mean that in the most sincerest form. It has been absolutely transformative from a practical outcome. Okay. It's changed the face of the game and it's positively affected people that in the past were hospitalized, institutionalized, and drugged to the point of ridiculous. So that kind of positive outcome and output is about the purpose of what we do, which is what? Efficacy, man. You know what I'm saying? It's like the number one rule of behavioral intervention is it needs to work. Okay, if it doesn't work, it's fucking pointless. It's a fruitless pursuit. So I really hope to have that discussion at some point because it's something I'm pretty passionate about.
Yeah,
from a variety of different advocacy points of view, and also from a variety of different scientific points of view. Quite frankly,
Yeah, and my point there was just like, we're doing our best to get some people involved on this, but also
I would love to see some people do it. Absolutely.
It's just time to also have these conversations and kind of forge the way forward. So just know the door is open to y'all listening if you want to be involved in those sort of things. If you want to do it for the same reasons that we want to do it. It's just a matter of like making those things happen. This has been rad, dude. Is there anything else we want to hit?
Man, I feel like we just smacked everything. I feel really good.
Yeah, this is
feeling
like,
super good.
It's almost like this is a form of like mindfulness or
something. It's weird. I'm so in the moment right now. Actually, this really helped me with some frustration I had throughout my day today. So I really appreciate it.
Dude, so.
You know what? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, I want to kick this straight to, like, I want to get this out quickly. I want to get this out to the Patreon folks, like, ASAP. So,
yeah. I had one final thing I kind of wanted to touch base with you, just more like a commentary.
Yeah, let's hit it.
The video that you put out today, and I guess this is going to date this, so you put out at some point on the imposter syndrome. Yeah. I thought that was very interesting video, man. I thought that guy was very insightful. I really appreciated his point of view.
Okay,
what was his name again?
Shane Spiker, man.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. The imposter syndrome is a very interesting idea that
I don't think we used the word syndrome, did we?
Maybe not.
Okay.
You just what word did you use?
I think I used imposter. I think a lot of people are doing that whole like associating with syndrome. More so, I'm just going to go back and double check.
I'm just using it as a colloquialism. If someone would, for whatever reason, intentionally take that as if I'm implying some explanatory fiction or mentalistic construct, like, fuck off.
Yeah,
like,
I just wanted to be respectful of people that may be diagnosed with imposter syndrome when we're just using
it. I didn't realize. I thought it was just a colloquialism.
It might not. I'm pretty sure it is. I'm not sure if it's in DSM. I think it is.
Really?
So my point was, Shane's the shit. Shane has been at NextGen. I had him come out and speak. He's helped me at some other places. He actually hit me up and he said, so good buddy of mine, man. And he said that he'd be really interested to talk about something with us, which is critical incidences and how behavior analysts are all traumatized. And he used this as like a quick.
Oh, kind dude, of, facts.
He used this as a quick kind of, like we'll refine and dive into that more. That's not to be like etched in the stone of like every behavior analyst is traumatized, but
there's a couple of articles on trauma that are pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I told him it's just, I'm like totally game if you're game and we can make that happen.
I get punched in the face for a living. Yeah. I can talk about that. Yes, dude. Absolutely. I would love to talk about that experience because it's one that I'm kind of afraid to talk about sometimes because the graphic nature of it makes people wince, but it is my and my staff's reality. So,
dude, to get back to the imposter part of it, I texted the guy at the conference. I was like, you got anything you want to share? Because he's a good buddy. He's been on the show a couple times like that. And he's like, yeah, I'm just going to riff. And we literally hung out and shot those couple quick segments and throw it together. I feel like a lot of people feel as though they can relate to that, man. I had a few different texts and DMs already today of just like, yo,
oh, dude,
I feel
such a real thing. It's such a real thing. We talked about similar things about this podcast recently where it's like, who are we? I'm just some random guy, you know, talking on, I'm a voice in someone's head. Am I even real? Like, do I even deserve to be considered an authority on anything? Like,
well,
I don't know.
Dude,
like,
I think comes down in our case, it comes down to articulation. Like what points are we making? Are we modeling the right amount of skepticism and like the right, a number of qualifiers? And then, dude, if there's one thing that I've learned, it's that, our field, I feel like, is easily 10 years behind like media trends and like what they should be doing. And
almost deaf.
If I can't convince and influence people to jump onto the podcast with us, then fuck it. Here we go. We're going to like show people like what can happen when you move these sort of things forward.
Oh, most deaf.
I'm glad to come back and do a version 2, just like they do in journals, how they're like, oops, messed up. Here's your edits from the last one. Like we can do the same sort of process.
Oh, of course.
There's no sense of waiting it out moving forward.
I'm not afraid to be wrong either. Like if I'm wrong about something, no problem, man. I'm a scientist. Give me the evidence. Give me the example. Show me where I'm wrong. And I don't even consider it eating crow. I consider it adjusting my point of view to match the evidence. Like it's logic, it's reasonable. It's what you're supposed to do. It's yeah. So I agree. Yeah, I'm with that all the way. I would love to have that conversation with that guy. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I think that was some of the like prereqs and repertoires that people needed to have to be able to hit the mic. Because dude, when we first started Why We Do What We Do, that podcast, we tried it like 2 years before, and like, I don't know, there was something in me where it's like, I just don't quite feel comfortable with this yet. And part of that was like getting behind a mic and like that sort of skill set you need to learn. But the other part was just like, can I have an average conversation with somebody and hang at a bar? Like one of the things that I used to use as like a litmus test for like my general knowledge in the field was like, did I know somebody and their work if they were on stage at the presentation that I was at or whatever? And then if I met somebody that somebody else in the field respected and they introduced me, could I have a conversation with them? Like, regardless of your stature, what it is, like last week I was at the Behavior Analysis Leadership Council, met a couple of people from Kennedy Krieger. We all know the stature that Kennedy Krieger brings in this sort of field. Absolutely. But it was like, can I have a conversation with you and can we find a middle ground? And yes, like I had an hour conversation. They have immense amount of knowledge and information ahead of me in different ways. But at the same time, like I was able to come with them with like this millennial, like youngsters perspective. I'm using air quotes of the people that are getting in the field now and like how to relate to people, dude. Well, what it was, so there's so many people now. They were sharing a story of how somebody in had their BCBA in the last like year. And they're like, hey, I have the same credentials as you. And they're telling that to someone that has their PhD for 30 years at Kennedy Krieger. And it's like, and my thing was like, yo, you guys need to hop on the mic and you need to hop on these videos and you need to like play with this new media because there's different ways to get in front of people now. And there's different ways to start to gain that sort of respect and communicate that respect. Absolutely. And I'm sorry that the times have changed, but hey, like I'm trying to figure that out. So what our conversation was, man, what my point was, is like, my litmus test is like, can I contribute to that conversation both in a couple ways? Like, can I in some way be an SME, a subject matter expert for those people, but can I also just like reference something or have something to talk about, like, contribute to that academic discussion like they were at the time?
Dude, can you engage in articulate, comprehensive, logical, critical thinking out loud? It's really like, come on, like no one owns words, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, just like talk, open your fucking mouth. Like that's all you got to, and see where it takes you and just practice it. A lot of this is just being able to articulate things in a quick manner and in a fluid fashion and practicing it over and over and over again. I think that, let's see, before we did this podcast, I tried my own thing and I think I had like 140 hours of episodes recorded that I released and then took back down because they were horrible. Yeah. And I don't even know if this is good. I feel like it's better. I've gotten better at it. I don't know if it is better, but it feels better.
Yeah.
And it's just about practice and thinking too. Like, you know, like you can't articulate a thing that you don't actually believe. That was going back to like the original thesis of this podcast and why the radical honesty piece to me is so important part of this process is because if you're speaking that truth, you don't have to think about it. And if you don't have to think about it, the authenticity oozes from your mouth. Mm-hmm. You know, the believability of it is there because there isn't, you believe it, you know? And the understandability of it is there and the general, you know, the general ability for it to actually disperse into the world and be accepted is a lot easier. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of different things to be said about acquiring the ability to speak and articulate. And, you know, is that a talent? I mean, again, I think all behaviors learn. So, I mean, sure, some people might have a natural predilection to certain things, but that's because, again, if you're overtly verbose in your life, you're going to, you know, acquire this skill faster. If you're not, you're gonna have to practice more. So it's just the way it is. But anyone and everyone can do it because everyone talks. At least 99% of people talk.
All right, I got a phone call shortly. Let's wrap this up.
Yeah, I gotta go too. Actually, all right, brother. Talking to you.
It's been
this was fucking fun, bro.
Yeah,
super fun one.
To all you listening, hit us in the comments wherever you're contacting this, whether it's Facebook, whether it's some sort of other social platform, Twitter, Instagram, Patreon. Please check out Patreon. It helped kind of support this model and keep it going. And we will see you all in the next one.
Hey friend, before you go, please just do us one small thing. Tell a friend, tag somebody, share this with another colleague in behavior analysis. That is the best way you can help us grow. Remember, you can call in on the Anchor app, anchor.fm/the controversial exchange. We can actually hear you, reply to that, include them in future episodes. So that is the easiest way to get your voice heard. If you'd like it to be anonymous, just state so when you submit it, and we can make sure that it is completely anonymous as well. Now, another way that you can really help this podcast grow is leaving us a review in iTunes, specifically on the podcasting app for Apple, and it just helps us reach more people. So whether you enjoyed it or not, please leave us a review. That feedback is helpful. Now, you can find us on social media by searching for The Controversial Exchange. Typically, our handle is Controversial Exchange. However, on Twitter, it is Controversial EX, just because we had to shorten that down a little bit. Now, lastly, there are YouTube videos for every single episode now. We are putting them out there. So please make sure you go check that out, especially if you want to see the visual of like what it is and how we're talking about these sort of things. That will be your place. And one last comment, and that is a quick disclaimer. Now, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice.